its former president Donald Trump has weathered scandals by keeping his intentions under wraps. But recent testimony paints a stark portrait of a man willing to do almost anything to hang on to power. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by the chief White House correspondent of the New York Times, Peter Baker. The piece is titled, New Insights into Trump's State of Mind on January 6th Chip Away at Doubts. He was not speaking metaphorically. It was not an offhand comment. President Donald Trump had every intention of joining a mob of supporters he knew to be armed and dangerous as it marched to the Capitol building in Washington. And there had even been talk of marching into the House chamber himself to disrupt Congress from ratifying his election defeat. For a year and a half, Donald Trump has been shielded by obfuscations and mischaracterizations, benefiting from uncertainty about what he was thinking on 6th of January 2021. If he truly believed the election had been stolen, if he genuinely expected the gathering at the Capitol would be a peaceful protest, the argument went, then could he be held accountable, much less indicted, for the mayhem that ensued? But for a man who famously avoids leaving emails or other trails of evidence of his unspoken motives, any doubts about what was really going through Mr. Trump's mind on that day of violence seem to have been eviscerated by testimony presented in recent weeks by the House committee investigating the Capitol attack, especially the dramatic appearance last week of a 26-year-old former White House aide who offered a chilling portrait of a president willing to do almost anything to hang on to power. More than perhaps any insider account that has emerged, the recollections of the aide, Cassidy Hutchinson, demolished the fiction of a president who had nothing to do with what happened. Each revelation was stunning on its own. Donald Trump knew what weapons were in the crowd as he exhorted supporters to fight like hell and even tried to stop anyone from disarming his supporters. He was so determined to join the mob at the Capitol that he lashed out at his Secret Service detail for refusing to take him. And he was so nonchalant about the bedlam he had unleashed that he suggested Vice President Mike Pence might deserve to be executed for refusing to overturn the election. But when added together, the various disclosures have produced the clearest picture yet of an unprecedented attempt to subvert the traditional American democratic process, with a sitting president who had lost at the ballot box planning to march with an armed crowd to the Capitol to block the transfer of power, brushing aside manifold concerns about the potential for violence along the way. The innocent explanations for Donald Trump's conduct seem virtually impossible to credit following the testimony we have seen, said Joshua Matz, who served as a lawyer for House Democrats during both of Mr. Trump's impeachment trials in the Senate. At the very least, they powerfully shift the burden to Trump and his defenders to offer evidence that he did not act with a corrupt, criminal state of mind. And so nearly 2.5 centuries after the 13 American colonies declared independence from an unelected king, the nation is left weighing a somber new view of the fragility of its democracy and the question of what, if anything, could and should be done about it. To the extent that there may be a turning point in that debate, Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony proved decisive for some who had been willing to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt or had been uncertain that the committee had gathered enough evidence about the former president's state of mind. Solomon Weisenberg, a former deputy independent counsel under Ken Starr, called her account the smoking gun, making a case for his criminal culpability on seditious conspiracy charges. Mick Mulvaney, who served as Donald Trump's third White House chief of staff, said he had been defending him, but learning that Mr. Trump knew some in the crowd were armed and still encouraged it to go to the Capitol certainly changes my mind, he told Fox News Channel. David French, a conservative critic of Donald Trump, had been skeptical the committee would produce sufficient evidence, but Cassidy Hutchinson's sworn testimony closes a gap in the criminal case against Donald Trump, he wrote on The Dispatch, a conservative website. Two law professors, Alan Rosenstein of the University of Minnesota and Jed Handelsman Sugarman of Fordham University, likewise opposed prosecution until seeing Ms. Hutchinson writing on the Lawfare blog that she changed their minds because she provided proof of intent. The hearings, which will continue after Congress returns on 11th of July from its holiday recess, have presented only the prosecution's side of the story. With Donald Trump's acquiescence, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Republican leader, opted against appointing anyone to the Select Committee after Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected a couple of his original selections, leaving the panel composed entirely of Democrats and just two Republicans deeply critical of the former president. Neither Cassidy Hutchinson nor any of the other witnesses who have testified have been cross-examined. Their testimony has often been presented in short edited clips rather than in their entirety, and no contrary testimony has been offered publicly. In a courtroom, if it ever came to that, the case against Donald Trump would be tested, as it has not been so far. The committee's presentation has been a purely political exercise, deceptively edited, said Jason Miller, who served as a political advisor to Donald Trump during and after the election. Yet even outside the confines of the hearing room, Mr. Miller and others in Donald Trump's camp have mainly attacked the committee or tried to chip away at pieces of the testimony rather than produce much of a defense of the former president's actions or an alternate explanation of his state of mind. In his social media posts, Donald Trump denied asking the armed supporters to be allowed at his rally. Who would ever want that, he wrote, not me. He focused more on his energy on castigating Cassidy Hutchinson in scathing personal terms and concentrated on one small aspect of her testimony, namely whether he lunged at the wheel of his presidential vehicle when his Secret Service detail refused to take him to the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. Throughout his time in politics, Donald Trump has survived one scandal after another, in part because people in the authority felt unable to read his mind. Investigators were not sure they could definitively prove that he intended to break the law when he authorized hush money to silence a film actress, or when he provided false valuations of his properties to lenders, or when he sought to impede the inquiry into Russia's election interference. Fact-checkers similarly documented tens of thousands of false statements he made while in office, but were reluctant to declare that he knowingly lied. He learned from Dad, Norman Vincent Peale, and especially Roy Cohn, that you can get away with almost anything if you never back down and insist long enough and loud enough that you're right. And he held onto that right up to the final ride. Back to the White House, said Gwenda Blair, his biographer, referring in turn to Fred Trump, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking, and Senator Joseph McCarthy's red-baiting chief counsel, who became a mentor to Donald Trump. For Mr. Trump, he was being completely consistent with the way he was acted his entire life. Anthony Scaramucci, a longtime associate who served briefly in the White House before breaking with Donald Trump, has talked in the past about Mr. Trump's power to interpret reality in whatever way suited him. But Mr. Scaramucci said he had concluded that Mr. Trump understood perfectly well that the election was not stolen and that his actions on 6th of January 2021 to overturn it were illegitimate. I do believe that President Trump knows that the whole thing that he is doing is a ruse, said Mr. Scaramucci. On more than one occasion throughout the campaign in 2016, he would turn to me and others and say funny things like, "Why can't people realise what you guys realise about me? That I'm play-acting and full of it at least 50% of the time." That sort of joking. So he knows that this is all a lie. What the hearings have demonstrated, with an array of witnesses drawn almost entirely from the president's own allies and advisers, is that if Donald Trump did not know, he certainly had every reason to. One adviser after another, including two successive attorney generals and multiple campaign officials and lawyers, told him there was no there, as one put it, when it came to widespread election fraud. Yet he persisted in spinning wild tales of conspiracies. While Attorney General Merrick Garland must weigh many factors before deciding whether to bring a case, including whether it is in the national interest to charge a former president, Cassidy Hutchinson's account of Donald Trump's actions leading up to and on 6th of January provided the building blocks for a possible prosecution by demonstrating that he and his advisers understood perfectly well they were playing with fire. While Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, claimed in a memoir that Donald Trump had only been speaking metaphorically when he vowed to march to the Capitol. In fact, he had discussed it for days. Cassidy Hutchinson first learned of the plan on 2nd of January 2021, when Rudolph Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, told her Mr. Trump would go to the Capitol and would look powerful. Alarmed, she found Mark Meadows, her boss. "It sounds like we're going to the Capitol," she said. Mr. Meadows did not look up from his phone, but made clear he understood the peril. "Things might get real, real bad on 6th of January," she remembered him telling her. On the morning of 6th of January, she listened as Mark Meadows was warned that some Trump supporters gathering at the rally on the Ellipse had weapons with them. Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, warned that Donald Trump should not go to the Capitol. "We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen," he said, according to Cassidy Hutchinson. Donald Trump was undaunted, though. Waiting in a tent to address the crowd, he brushed off worries about violence. He criticized the Secret Service for screening supporters with magnetometers, standard procedure for a presidential event, and demanded that they be removed. "They're not here to hurt me," he said. "Take the mags away. Let my people in." Addressing the crowd, he declared that he would go with them to the Capitol. But when he climbed into his armored vehicle, the Secret Service officials refused to take him, citing his own security. According to what Ms. Hutchinson said, she was later told by Anthony Ornato, a deputy White House chief of staff, that Mr. Trump erupted in rage and demanded to go to the Capitol. They returned to the White House instead, where Donald Trump stewed about being thwarted. And he watched television images of his supporters rampaging through the Capitol. He agreed with those in the crowd calling on Mike Pence to be hanged. Indeed, according to Ms. Hutchinson's testimony, he was on the side of the mob. As she heard Mark Meadows put it, "He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
We'll be right back. A new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which requires the full or partial disclosure of previously unreleased information and documents controlled by the U.S. government upon request, offers the first official confirmation of Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple countries. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allows U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. And now, the report indicated that American troops conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world between 2017 and 2020. The document also shows that at least 14 127E programs were also active in West Asia and the Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in West Asia, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E so-called counter-terrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen.
The actual main purpose of U.S. Special Forces is to train and educate foreign fighters, and so they've done this in places that we would never that the United States people would never support in Africa, Central America, and places like that. And in fact, we created the School of the Americas, which trained Central American people to. How to torture people properly.
The 127E program, an obscure program that even U.S. lawmakers are not familiar with, one that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by, with, and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. But all this only seems to be another term for waging a proxy war in another country through the use of local forces. The origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support militants there. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known as Section 1208, the authority was deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion, according to a former senior defense official. It was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, Section 127E. But so far, the U.S. waging of proxy wars and its use of local forces to achieve its aims have been costly for countries targeted by Washington.
I guess I would use the example of the Philippines, where Duterte, who was a very right-leaning president, kicked the United States Special Forces out, even though they were operating in his space. In support of what he was doing, he kicked them out because he just didn't want that element in his country. American foreign policy is insane in every way that it possibly can be.
Critics in the U.S. have also contended that, due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders, on the other hand, claim it is crucial to combating terrorism. But so far, the U.S.'s proxy wars in most countries where this program has been implemented, including West Asian nations like Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, have mostly been witnessing instability, which is more likely than not a direct result of the program and proxy elements and fighters. We'll be right back. Racist policies are enshrined in Israeli law. However, one specifically denies 6 million Palestinians the right to return to the territory from which they were expelled only a few decades ago. The same law, however, permits Jews across the world to settle in any part of Palestine. Such practices, including the racial fragmentation of Palestine into zones of control, where half of the population enjoys full rights of citizenship denied to the non-Jewish half, have led most human rights groups and advocates to label Israel as an apartheid state. Meanwhile, Israel continuously and explicitly rejects international consensus and seems to have found strong support for their radical position from the Texas Republican Party in foreclosing any chance of a Palestinian state from ever being established.
Violence and instability are perhaps a good thing because violence implies that there will be resistance to this land grab and this denial of Palestinian rights. And as far as I'm concerned, the more resistance, the better. And Palestine needs to do resistance, and it needs its friends and allies to participate in resistance. I know that the policy of Iran and Syria and some other nations is to support Palestine in this kind of resistance. And in fact, it is now going in the direction that the entire world is saying, well, we're not going to listen to the United States anymore and NATO, for example, because the United States has now declared sanctions against so many countries that those countries are unifying amongst themselves to defy the United States. So we may be entering a new period when, unfortunately, violence, but resistance and most likely violent resistance is the only answer to the warmongers.
Though party platforms do not necessarily translate into government policy, critics cite the former U.S. President Donald Trump and the support enjoyed by Israel amongst powerful religious figures, as well as fringe elements in the U.S. society, to argue that the most extreme and rejectionist views about the apartheid have become normalized in U.S. politics. In further signs that support for Israel has morphed into an extremist position in the U.S., the Texas Republican Party has approved a platform that will make it illegal to create a Palestinian state in territories controlled by Israel. The platform, approved by 5,100 delegations in Houston, supports the prohibition of a Palestinian state within the so-called historical borders of Israel, as they claim it would jeopardize Israel's security. This platform, in essence, only lays the groundwork for further Israeli aggression and discrimination against Palestinians. Currently, as many as 12 million people reside in historic Palestine, but full rights are granted by the regime to Jews only, leaving the remaining 6 million non-Jews prone to various forms of racial discrimination depending on their place of residence. But does this type of platform represent the thinking of the U.S. as a whole when it comes to Palestinians, that they shouldn't have a right to their own land?
The United States has a long tradition of denying people their land rights and their homeland. We've done it to 500 nations in North America. So this is not at all surprising that they would say that the Palestinians should be denied their homeland. At the same time, the Zionists are immensely powerful and have powerful friends in the United States. So, particularly in the power structure and the political structure,
All this poses some serious question about the future of Palestinians in light of the US and Israeli plots amid what seems to be international silence over the matter.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital, Madrid, to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliaments and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit. And this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the US is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over 1 million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth, to kill thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Officials should have both piety and purity, and expertise and competence. Commitment to Islamic values as well as expertise. These are dualisms that some people try to set against one another before or in the beginning of the revolution, but Imam harmonized and brought them together. These are the characteristics of Imam's school of thought. Well, you may ask a question here, asking to what extent Imam's school was realized in his own time or will be realized in the future. This is an important question that others may also pose to us. I'd say, based on reliable information and a study about the realities of the country, that we have made good achievements in all these areas. If someone denies these achievements, they are definitely being unfair.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We have had many accomplishments in all these areas, including democracy, scientific achievements, diplomatic issues, the status of the country in the world, the economy, and public services. Of course, we have also had our share of failures. We have had both achievements and failures and weaknesses. Here too, Imam was provided intelligent guidance for us. Imam's guidance is of huge help to us. In the last year of his life, he said something to the children of martyrs. He said, "Your performance sheet depends on your effort and diligence. The more you work and try, the more results you will achieve." Imam continued, "Living in today's world is living in the school of willpower. Life depends on willpower. Whenever the nation and officials enter the field with firm willpower, they will succeed. And whenever willpower becomes shaky and efforts decrease, there will be backwardness." Yes, we have had some failures and some achievements. This is a matter related to us. We officials and the masses of people in society were involved in all matters. In certain cases, we acted well and made achievements, and in certain cases, we showed negligence and laziness and weakness, and we naturally fell behind.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Limelight. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says growing North and South divide is morally unacceptable and dangerous. We are prepared for you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled UN Chief Says Perfect Storm of Crises is Widening Global Inequality. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned humanity is facing a perfect storm of crises that is widening inequality between the North and the South. The divide is not only morally unacceptable but dangerous, further threatening peace and security in a conflicted world. Antonio Guterres said the global food, energy and financial crises unleashed by the war in Ukraine have hit countries already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic and the climate crisis, reversing what had been a growing convergence between developed and developing countries. Antonio Guterres added, inequalities are still growing inside countries, but they are now growing in a morally unacceptable way between the North and the South. And this is creating a divide which can be very dangerous from the point of view of peace and security. Antonio Guterres, who spoke to The Guardian at the United Nations Ocean Conference in his hometown of Lisbon in Portugal recently, said his biggest concern was how global problems were widening the gap between the rich and the poor. He said, "What is worrying is we are living in a perfect storm, because all crises are contributing to the dramatic increases in inequality in the world and to a serious deterioration in living conditions for the most vulnerable populations." All these escalated a situation in which a world that was looking like it was converging between developing countries and developed countries, even if inequality were growing within countries north and south. Now we are back to a divergence. Recently, the head of the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, warned dozens of countries dependent on wheat from Russia and Ukraine risked protests, riots, and political violence as global food prices surged. Antonio Guterres said all the crises facing the world, the climate crisis was the most vital. He added, "That is why it is so concerning that the conflict in Ukraine has to a large extent kept out the focus on climate action. We need to do everything we can to bring again the climate issue as the most important issue in our collective agenda. It's more than the planet, it is the human species that is also at risk." The UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres noted that while many important topics were addressed at the COP26 United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow, Scotland last November, the central question of how to reduce emissions was not seriously discussed and continues to be ignored. He said there was agreement that to keep global warming down to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, deep cuts of 45% in carbon emissions by 2030 compared with 2010 levels were needed. But we are moving in the wrong direction. The UN Secretary General added, "The truth is that if we look at the national determined contributions we have today and what was announced before, during and immediately after COP26 summit, we're still moving into an increase of emissions of 14%. He added, "We have the risk of sleepwalking into the killing of the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise goal. Something is being done, but it is too little too late. If we want to keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive, we need to have a massive determination to reduce carbon emissions as quickly as possible." He said all indicators suggest the effects of the climate crisis are accelerating faster than the worst predictions of a few years ago. Early this month, Guterres hit out at fossil fuel companies, describing them and the banks that finance them as having humanity by the throat, and castigated governments that failed to rein in fossil fuels and were in many cases seeking to increase production of gas, oil and even coal, the dirtiest of the fossil fuels. Asked about the backsliding of European Union countries that have announced plans to reopen coal-fired electricity-generating power stations in response to Russia's restriction of gas flows into Europe, Antonio Guterres said, "Coal is number one, is enemy number one of climate action." The UN Secretary General has called on Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD countries, to phase out all coal plants by 2030, and in other countries by 2040. He said, "I hope these examples of countries where some coal will be burnt will be for a very short period of time." Germany, a country heavily dependent on Russian gas, announced it would reopen mothballed coal-fired stations to conserve its supplies, following Russia's restrictions of gas flows into Germany. France has signalled it may reopen a coal station due to the situation in Ukraine. Antonio Guterres said the war had highlighted our dependence on fossil fuels. He said, "It is the instability in the fossil fuel market that is creating these dramatic impacts in rising energy prices and contributing to rising food prices and to the extremely difficult financial situation for many developing countries. If the world had invested massively, as it should have done, in the past decade on renewable energies, we would today be in a completely different situation." He added, "We need to learn lessons of the past." At the United Nations conference attended by global leaders and heads of state, the heads of small island developing states such as Palau, Fiji and Tonga spoke of the devastating impact on their countries from increasing typhoons and a rise in sea level. The Minister for Climate Change in Vanuatu, Silas Bulemelve, said the climate crisis was the single biggest threat to the country's efforts to expand its blue economy. On Monday, 4th of July, Antonio Guterres declared the world was in the middle of an ocean emergency and condemned the egoism of some countries that were hampering efforts to reach a long-awaited treaty to protect the world's oceans. A long-standing promise made in 2009 and brought to the fore at the COP26 summit in Glasgow from rich countries to provide £100 billion a year in climate finance to the developing world has not yet been delivered. Antonio Guterres said, although this finance was a small part of what is needed, the failure to honour the promise of providing it year after year has added to the division between rich and poor countries. He said, "It probably won't happen in 2022. This makes developing countries feel that there is indeed not a strong commitment of solidarity. Small island developing states feel it with particular intensity." He said there is a risk of the next COP summit to be negatively impacted by this frustration of developing countries and lack of confidence and trust in the seriousness of the support of the developed world. "And this would be tragic because we really need to mobilise everybody. We need everybody committed if we want to keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive." Asked what gave him hope, Guterres said he had met many young people in Lisbon, part of a youth forum aiming to develop ideas and solutions to the ocean and climate emergencies. He said their depth of knowledge, their clarity, commitment in their proposals, and their enthusiasm is my best hope. Antonio Guterres concluded by saying, "Young people are engaged. We see more and more cities, more and more civil society, and even more areas of the private sector that are engaged. Governments are now becoming probably the entities that are moving more slowly."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Tehran has organized a fourth edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
The Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception.
Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Protesters blocking lanes and taking part in slowdowns on busy roads across the UK.
Give us our country back!
Organized on social media by Fuel Price Stand Against Tax, they're demanding deeper cuts in fuel duty. Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a 5 pence cut in March, but that has not meant much at the forecourts.
Fuel prices in the UK have hit record highs since the beginning of the year. Only a few months ago, it would have cost roughly $90 to fill up, let's say, a 50-litre tank. But now it'll cost $30 more to fill up that same tank.
And that has put the squeeze on the finances of people. Some have had to quit their jobs because they couldn't afford the commute anymore. Businesses, too, are feeling the pinch at the pump and are passing the extra costs onto the consumers, worsening the cost of living crisis.
Worst of all, the poorest are suffering the most. You can't just switch off your power, you can't switch off your car, you can't switch off your central heating. And when winter comes, people will freeze. All of that, a direct consequence of this government's failure to have a joined-up energy policy, and we are literally paying the consequences.
Among the biggest factors contributing to the fuel price hikes, the UK's green energy policy and Western sanctions on Russian energy exports in the wake of the Ukraine war. Sanctions that the UK government was among the first to impose.
The sanctions imposed upon Russia for political reasons have clearly pushed up the energy costs. But secondly, and even more importantly, Britain has an idiotic environmental policy where they import the very fossil fuels that they depend on, even though under our feet there are £1 trillion worth of gas, and in the North Sea there are billions of pounds worth of oil.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hinted at a rise in UK oil and gas output, but critics say it would have little effect on consumer bills. And as long as the UK, along with its Western allies, fans the flames of the war in Ukraine, scenes like this may well become more frequent. Said Puriza, London.
Now
thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the holy city of Mecca